have a wonderful group, and I'm not going to repeat everything that's up there because I probably won't pronounce it right, but I think I've got their names right. The presenters are Lise, Aaron, Kaylee, Aaron, and Lindsay. And so we're going to hear a bit about Meningomyelitis Seal, and take it away. Were there any questions from yesterday? Good. Oh, I took her notes. I promised I wouldn't, but yeah, no offense.
I didn't memorize it, so. Okay, good morning, everyone. I'd like to introduce our systematic review titled The Effects of Electrical Stimulation, Exercise Training, and Motor Skills Training on Strength for Children with Meningomyelitis Seal. Our group members are Lise Dagenet, myself, Erin LaHaye, Kaylee Stuck, Erin White, and Lindsay Williams. So before we begin, we'd like to acknowledge two people that made the systematic review possible. First of all, Susan Harris was our mentor and supervisor throughout the process. She's done so much work with children that she's been a great asset to our team. And secondly, Charlotte Beck, the reference librarian, was also an invaluable resource as she guided us through the databases and helped us with the searching process. So we divided our systematic review into the following five sections: introduction, purpose, methods, results, and discussion. I will be introducing our topic and describing the purpose. Lise and Kaylee will discuss the methods. Erin will describe the results. And finally, Lindsay will conclude with the discussion at the end. So now I will begin by introducing our topic. Since we looked at studies that examined the specific interventions for spina bifida, I'd first like to discuss the congenital condition. Spina bifida is a congenital abnormality that results from incomplete closure of the spinal column. Its prevalence is approximately 1 out of 1,000 births annually, and 94% of the cases are meningomyelitis seal, a form in which there is protrusion of the spinal cord through an opening in the vertebral canal, and it is often located in the lumbosacral area. This slide shows three types of spina bifida. The first picture is spina bifida occulta. A protrusion of the spinal cord or meninges does not exist in this type, and often symptoms are not present. The middle picture depicts meningocele, which involves a protrusion of the meninges only. And the far right picture illustrates meningomyelitis seal, which is the focus of the review and is the most common form. It involves the spinal cord, nerve root, and meninges, all of which may protrude through the vertebral defect. Nerve damage occurs below the level of the lesion in spina bifida. Common impairments associated with the condition include muscle weakness or paralysis, loss of lower extremity sensation, and bowel and bladder dysfunction. Hydrocephalus is often commonly associated with spina bifida and can lead to other complications such as learning disabilities. So while we were researching into the history of spina bifida, we found a few interesting facts. Although the skeletons of people with spina bifida date back to 10,000 BC, the first clear description of the condition in the West was not until the 16th century. In the 19th and 20th century, the various types and severities of spina bifida were first described. In the past, chances of survival were slim, and treatments in the 16th century were disastrous. Thus, long-term consequences were uncommon. The use of myofascial flaps were introduced in the 19th century, and this surgical procedure is still being performed today. There is a need for a multidisciplinary approach to treatment in spina bifida, and the involved healthcare worker, the doctor, the physiotherapist, occupational therapist, and the dietitian. Some specific areas that a physiotherapist will address include muscle strengthening, positioning, orthoses, postural control, and mobility, but the overall goal of the physiotherapist is the promotion of functional independence. Mobility training is directed at promoting the learning of effective adaptive motor behaviors. The evidence regarding the efficacy of physiotherapy interventions for children with meningomyelitis seal is limited. For example, we were able to locate only one systematic review on the topic. Written by Mazur and Kyle, this article was on the efficacy of bracing and ambulation training. It looked at the literature published between 1974 and 2003 using Medline and the Cumulative Index to Nursing and Allied Health Literature databases. Similar to our systematic review, this one states that no conclusive findings are evident and concludes that further research is necessary. The lack of evidence on meningomyelocele interventions is in contrast to the vast body of research around cerebral palsy, another common disorder affecting motor abilities in children. When examining the available literature, the majority of the articles on spina bifida are prior to 1995 and are of moderate quality, whereas many articles on cerebral palsy are current and are of greater quality. A systematic review conducted by Dodd and colleagues in 2002 on the effectiveness of strength training for cerebral palsy returned 23 relevant articles. 11 were high-quality articles, while our systematic review produced only one high-quality article. This gap in the literature is of great importance, as physiotherapy plays a major role in the functioning of children with meningomyelocele, and there is little evidence to guide best practice. So that brings us to the purpose of the systematic review, and that is to provide an overview of the existing research regarding the effects of electrical stimulation, exercise training, and motor skills training on muscle strengthening for children with meningomyelocele. And next, Lise will come up and speak.
I'd like to now turn your focus to our systematic review methods. Our systematic review involved a search of 9 electronic databases limited to the English language. Listed here are the electronic databases that were searched. We searched PEDRO, Cochrane's Central Register of Controlled Trials, DARE, Database of Abstract and Reviews of Effect, CIRI, Center for International Rehabilitation Research, Cochrane Database, PubMed, Embase, CINAHL, and Medline. These databases were searched using meningomyelocele and physical therapy as the main search terms. Then the reference lists of the selected articles were then hand-searched for further potentially relevant citations. All 5 reviewers participated in the literature search. To ensure that our search was exhaustive and thorough, we used multiple search terms for the diagnosis, the intervention, and the outcomes. Multiple search terms were necessary because the 9 electronic databases searched recognized different search terms. Listed here are some of the examples of the search terms we used. Examples of search terms used for the diagnosis include spina bifida, meningomyelocele, and spinal dysrhythism. Examples of search terms used for the intervention include physical therapy modalities, rehabilitation, exercise, and electrical stimulation. And lastly, examples of search terms used for the outcomes included functional mobility, muscle strength, gait, and ambulation. During the systematic review process, citations were initially screened by titles, then by article abstracts, and finally by the full text of the articles. During this process, 2 reviewers examined each article for its potential relevance. If reviewers were uncertain of the citation's relevance, it was then kept for the next screening process. Any disagreements regarding the inclusion or exclusion of the article were settled by a third member. To be included in this review, studies had to fulfill the following inclusion criteria. Oops. Oh, can you go there? Sorry about that. The studies first had to have participants diagnosed with meningomyelocele. Second, participants had to be diagnosed, had to be of 21 years of age or under. And third, the study had to involve a physical therapy intervention. A number of articles were also excluded for reasons listed on the screen. Articles were excluded if they were part of book chapters, if they were duplicate publications, or if their focus was on surgical techniques orthoses, bowel and bladder function, cognition, or scoliosis. No studies were excluded based on the quality or the level of evidence due to the limited number of articles found. Our inclusion-exclusion criteria was kept quite broad due to the limited number of articles we acquired through our search process. However, after the data extraction and initial analysis of the full text, the remaining 11 studies were found to be extremely heterogeneous, making data synthesis impractical. Therefore, the inclusion criteria was further modified to include only studies which used strength as an outcome measure, thus reducing the number of included studies to 6. Our final inclusion criteria, written in a PICO format, is as follows. The population in all included studies had to have participants who were 21 years of age and under with a diagnosis of meningiomyocele. Also, in order to be included, the studies had to have an intervention of either electrical stimulation, exercise training, or motor skills training. Also, for the comparison component of PICO, we did not exclude any studies if there was no comparison due to the few number of studies. Lastly, all studies included in our systematic review had to have the outcome of strength. And now I'm going to turn everything over to Kaylee, who will continue to talk about the methods.
Okay, so the process of study selection, which eventually resulted in 6 articles to be included in this systematic review, is illustrated by this flowchart. The light green boxes on the right represent studies that were excluded, while the bright green boxes on the left represent studies that were kept throughout the process. So the lit search resulted in 298 potentially relevant citations. The inclusion and exclusion criteria, which least described, was applied to these titles. This excluded 160 articles, which left 138 for the next level of study selection. Based on abstract screening criteria, 120 articles were excluded, which left 18 for full text review. And at this time, hand searching the reference list of these articles was completed, and 2 additional articles were included for full text retrieval. After full text review of the 20 relevant articles, 11 satisfied inclusion and exclusion criteria. As Lise also previously described, these articles were heterogeneous, and the outcomes ranged from cardiopulmonary function and strength to functional mobility. After modification of the screening criteria, 5 studies were excluded as they did not use strength as an outcome measure. This left 6 studies that investigated the effects of physical therapy interventions on strength to be included in this systematic review. At the level of full text screening, studies were excluded for the following reasons. 5 studies did not use strength as an outcome measure. 3 were duplicate publications. 2 did not use a relevant physical therapy intervention. 1 focused on the management of scoliosis. 1 did not include participants with a diagnosis of meningiomyocele. 1 was a book chapter, and 1 study included adult participants. So this slide simply summarizes our search results and categorization of the included articles. Of the resulting 6 studies investigating strengthening for children with meningiomyocele, 2 used electrical stim, 3 used exercise programs, and 1 used motor skills training as interventions. To assess quality of the 6 articles selected for this review, they were first graded according to the American Academy for Cerebral Palsy and Developmental Medicine, also known as the AACPDM, levels of evidence. Based on this grade, studies were organized into 3 groups, level 2, level 4, and level 5. The 6 studies were evenly distributed with 2 in each group. These ratings were completed for each article by 2 independent reviewers, and the level of agreement for this process was 100%. The AACPDM quality assessment tool was used to evaluate the quality of articles included in the level 2 group, which included 2 pre-test, post-test control group designs. This tool assessed various aspects of the studies, such as inclusion criteria, description and adherence to interventions, validity and reliability of measures, blinding, and statistical evaluations. It also looked at dropouts and the ability to limit bias in the studies. The quality of level 4 and level 5 articles was completed using a questionnaire that was developed for case studies by Dean and colleagues, authors of a 2006 systematic review. This tool was chosen as the AACPDM quality assessment tool would have scored these studies extremely low due to study design, which we felt was inappropriate and not adequately representative of study quality. Articles in this group included 2 1-group pretest post-test designs and 2 single-subject designs. This tool assessed clarity of the study purpose and hypothesis and description of participants, interventions, and measures. It also looked at effect size as well as the identification of study limitations. This table illustrates the results of study quality assessment. As was mentioned previously, the two level two studies utilize the AACPDM quality assessment tool, while the level 4 and 5 studies utilize the case study quality assessment tool. All questions were answered yes or no, with yes scoring 1 point and no scoring 0. The AACPDM grading criteria for quality assessment was used to rate studies as strong, moderate, or low quality. Studies were determined to be of strong quality if they obtained a score of 6 or 7, moderate quality with a score of 4 or 5, and weak with a score of less than or equal to 3. The level 4 study by Masley and colleagues was classified as strong quality, scoring a 6 out of 7. The other 6 studies were classified as moderate, scoring either 4 or 5 out of 7. These ratings were completed for each article by 2 independent reviewers. The reviewers initially agreed on 35 out of 42 questions, producing a level of agreement score of 83%. As there were some discrepancies in the ratings, a third reviewer was occasionally required. For data extraction, a standardized form was developed and used to collect relevant information from each article. This was completed independently by 2 reviewers to help decrease subjectivity and ensure thoroughness. Relevant information was then jointly entered by reviewers into summary tables for further investigation. Data analysis was then conducted using a descriptive synthesis method. This method, as described by the Center for Reviews and Dissemination, includes evaluating the participants, interventions, and outcomes of the studies to determine whether findings can be generalized to the greater population. Limitations are investigated and missing components are noted in order to progress research in the area of interest. A meta-analysis was not conducted in the systematic review due to the variability of research designs. Studies also varied in terms of population age and outcome measures used. So I'll now pass it on to Erin, who will present the results.
All right, so the next few slides summarize the interventions and results of the studies used in the systematic review. The results have been grouped into 3 categories based on the physiotherapy interventions used. As stated previously, these interventions are electrical stimulation, exercise training, and motor skills training. Carmel Ross and colleagues, and Maslia and colleagues, investigated the effects of electrical stimulation on quadriceps muscle strength in children with meningomyosis. Carmel Ross conducted a pretest post-test control group design, and Maslia conducted a 1-group pretest post-test design. While these articles both studied the effects of electrical stimulation on lower extremity strengthening, they used much different parameters. Carmel Ross applied electrical stimulation to the quadriceps muscle of a randomly assigned limb in conjunction with walking and standing activities and used the contralateral limb as a control. Maslia applied electrical stimulation to the quadriceps bilaterally for 1 to 2 hours daily for 6 months. This was a much longer duration than Carmel Ross, which implemented 30-minute sessions 6 times a week for only an 8-week period. Measurements of isometric knee extension torque were used to determine the effectiveness of both the electrical stimulation interventions. Carmel Ross found statistically significant improvements in knee extension torque in 2 out of 5 participants after 8 weeks. Maslia demonstrated improvements in knee extension torque in 2 out of 3 participants after 6 months of electrical stimulation. These 2 studies demonstrate that quadriceps torque can be increased by electrical stimulation in children with meningomyosis. The 3 articles that investigated the effects of exercise training on upper extremity strength included a pretest, post-test test control group design by Andrade and colleagues, a one-group pretest, post-test design by O'Connell and Barnhart, and a single subjects design by Rapport and Bailey. The Level 2 study by Andrade implemented a 10-week program which included upper extremity resistance training in combination with a warm-up, aerobic training, and a cool-down for 1 hour per week for 10 weeks. The warm-up and cool-down consisted of slow rhythmical exercises and slow sustained stretches. The strength training component included isotonic and dynamic exercises. Specific exercises included shoulder flexion and abduction, elbow flexion and extension, and abdominal exercises. The study by O'Connell and Barnhart was of similar duration for 9 weeks, but included only resistance training in 30-minute sessions 3 times per week. The upper extremity training program included anti-gravity exercises using weights, and this weight was increased weekly. We recognize that this study included both children with meningomyelitis and cerebral palsy, and due to a small sample size, comparisons between the groups were made. Rapport and Bailey investigated upper extremity strength, post-fine and gross motor activity interventions. Examples of fine and gross motor activities include needlepoint and block design. These interventions were implemented in both the clinical setting for 6 weeks and within a home program for 56 weeks. Andrade, as well as O'Connell and Barnhart, reported significant improvements in upper extremity strength post-resistance training. The study by Andrade found statistically significant results in the experimental group compared to the control group using a handheld dynamometer. Statistically significant results were also acquired in the study by O'Connell and Barnhart using 6-rep max testing. Functional activities such as wheelchair propulsion were also shown to increase in this study. Both of these studies demonstrated that resistance training programs using appropriate parameters can provide adequate stimulus to increase upper extremity strength in children with meningomyelitis. The third study that investigated the effects of exercise training by Rapport and Bailey also demonstrated improvements in strength using a handheld dynamometer and a pinch meter. Similar to our motor skills training study by Manila and Varney, the behavioral aspect of physical therapy was considered a key element with regards to positive therapeutic outcomes. The final category, motor skills training, with Manila and Varney, implemented a single subjects design to explore the effectiveness of motor skills training in conjunction with behavioral therapy on strength. The motor skills included sit to stand, standing erect, ambulation in parallel bars, and three-point gait using a rolling walker. Behavioral therapy included social and food reinforcers to encourage participation in the functional-based activities, and these reinforcers were gradually removed over the 4-week period. The case study by Manila and Varney reported an improvement in quadriceps strength from a grade 3 to a grade 4 bilaterally after 4 weeks of motor skills training and behavioral therapy. This study illustrated the effectiveness of motor skills training as well as the value of behavioral therapy in pediatric healthcare delivery. And now we'll turn it over to Lindsay.
So this systematic review concludes there is a positive trend towards increasing muscle strength using electrical stimulation, exercise training, and motor skills training for children with meningomyelitis. Due to the small number and the variability within the studies, optimal treatment protocols could not be determined, but it is important to note that all studies did show improvements in strength, with 3 stating statistically significant improvements. Also, no adverse effects were noted in any of the studies. Recommendations may change or become clear when stronger evidence is available. So a few more charts for you. This is just a summary on some of the similarities and differences we noted when we were attempting to draw our conclusions. This shows the 2 studies on electrical stimulation again. And what I just want to look at here is the study by Carmel Ross. It is of higher quality, partly due to their use of a control. They also incorporated more functional movements during the treatment and subsequently demonstrated improvements in functional activities such as gait distance and velocity. You'll notice that Mozilla used a sedentary treatment design and did not find any resulting improvements in gait. Mozilla required the family or participant to implement the electrical stimulation, and this may have increased the risk of low adherence or ineffective application. It's also important to note that Carmel Ross, they did discuss their small number of significant findings. You may remember Aaron said they showed statistically significant improvements in 2 of 5 subjects. They did discuss the other 3 participants. 2 of those other children were a very young age, and it was noted they had difficulty following the instructions for the isometric torque measurements when it came to testing. It was interesting that for the more functional tasks they measured, like stair climbing, where they were able to understand the task clearly, they showed much more improvement in their test score. The remaining child in their study did have a deterioration in their condition during the study duration, which resulted in a loss of their muscular strength, and therefore they were not able to make strength gains. When we compared the studies on the 3 on exercise training, for 2 of the studies, the study by Andrade and the one by O'Connell, they used very similar strengthening exercises, but with very different protocols. And the resulting, they both demonstrated statistically significant improvement. All these studies on exercise training looked at children with higher lesions than the studies on electrical stimulation. Therefore, ambulation was not possible, and their focus was on the upper extremity. Andrade noted improvements in 3 of 5 measures on all of their subjects and suggested that their treatment that consisted of dynamic exercise with an endurance focus may not have been reflected entirely by the isometric testing. In addition to gains in strength, O'Connell was able to show marked improvement in function, which they represented by wheeling times. This paper went into detail on the importance of upper extremity exercises for function and independence. So this is a good example of the difficulty in determining appropriate protocol and the need for research to use standardized parameters to enable generalizability for practice. The study on Rapport and Bailey, we had difficulty comparing to the other 2 studies due to a very different training protocol and duration, but they did find improvements in all areas they measured. For the 1 study on motor skills training, recommendations are not possible, but this study does highlight the value of using functional training to gain functional improvements, and they also bring about important insight into the value of behavioral therapy when working with children, which was also noted in one of the exercise training studies. Several limitations are recognized within a systematic review. The search strategy was limited to English and to published articles. Gray literature was not searched extensively, possibly overlooking current information. A meta-analysis was not possible due to the variability of research design, intervention protocol, age of participants, and outcome measures used. Therefore, data analysis was completed using a descriptive synthesis method that Kaylee described. All of the studies were limited by small sample size. The largest of our studies included only 13 participants, and that was the study by Andrade. The studies were also very dated, with the most recent study in our review by O'Connell and Barnhart in 1995. Our systematic review found only 2 studies of level 2 evidence, 1 for electrical stimulation, the other exercise training. The remaining 4 are considered relatively weak evidence, and because credible results enable generalizability and applicability of treatment approaches to the population of interest, the results of these studies are difficult to apply to the general population of children with meningomyocele. Despite these limitations, the studies still bring forth very important aspects of therapy and are considered valuable in the systematic review. Even with the low levels of evidence, our quality assessment reveals that our studies are of strong or moderate quality. Valuable components include the investigations of both upper and lower extremities, as well as the very functional approach that these studies took to relate strength gains to real-life performance. Strengths of the systematic review include our extensive literature search, including monthly updates from databases, the use of all 5 reviewers to limit biases during data extraction and analysis, an excellent inter-rater reliability, and access to an expert in the field. Areas for future research include further investigation of the potential effects of electrical stimulation on ambulation ability and in the prevention of knee flexion contractures. Although literature regarding strength training for this population is limited, pediatric strength training is supported in orthopedic literature. It may be beneficial for physical therapy researchers to investigate additional areas in the treatment approach, such as compliance, motivation, education, and the importance of parental involvement when applying these principles to children with meningomyelocele. As you can see from our results in the study designs, optimal treatment protocols and duration need to be determined with an emphasis on the value of allowing time for practice and perseverance, especially in the population of children with disabilities. So in conclusion, this review supports aspects of physical therapy interventions. The literature is out of date and scarce. In order to ensure physical therapy is delivered in an effective and efficient manner, further research is necessary. So, we'd like to leave you with a very quick motivational video to demonstrate the important role physical therapists can play in these children's lives, and as a little encouragement to further the research in this area. Yay, Micah. So here are some of our references. If anyone would like to get those emailed, I'll send those out. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Well, at first we did, and our study was very confusing, and in consulting with Susan, we decided to narrow our focus so we could have a more effective comparison between the studies.
And we found a lot of the articles didn't, even if they used functional outcomes or measures, there wasn't a specific physical therapy intervention to get there, so even though they discussed it, it was hard for us to tell what the physical therapist did, so strength was one of the ways we could make sure it was applicable to physical therapists.
Thank you.
Yes. You talked about the size of the change when you reported on manual muscle testing from grade 3 to 4. I wonder if you can just comment on the size of the improvement or the magnitude of change in those couple of studies where you said it was statistically significant. What sort of in percentage improvement, or how much stronger
were they? No, they did list them, and I don't remember offhand, but they did list them as a percentage. I'm sorry, I don't remember
either. Okay. We could get it for you.
I was confused. A couple of the studies were alternately referred to as single subject studies or case studies. And as you know, those are very different.
Yeah.
And I think it was maybe the...
I think that was, we had changed the names of our studies after, and then we forgot to switch over. But they were all single subject.
It was a single subject research design.
I think when we first started,
we used the term
case study. And then when we looked at Portney and Watkins, the textbook, we discovered it was the wrong name, so we switched it to single subject, so we may have missed changing.
So both the Rapport and Bailey and the Manella and Barney were
single subject.
You stop thinking now. You crazy work.
I don't know if you guys know, but I was just wondering why there's such a difference in the amount of research for children with cerebral palsy versus meningomyelitis.
I don't know if Susan can maybe answer that better. We weren't sure. It was surprising, the difference.
Is it the prevalence of it?
The amount of children?
The prevalence isn't that really different, because CP's one to two per thousand, I think. Am I right, Lori?
Yeah, about two.
Two per thousand. So, what do you think, Lori? I mean, it's a conundrum. Why?
I think it's a combination, but also some of the PT researchers in their grad studies, I think, just thinking of some of the researchers that would have been investigating strength, their research environments where they were trained, I think were more focused than they want to see because of CP.
Which is, it's appalling that this group has been so under-researched.
It is. It's a great, I'm really interested to hear your review summarizing it because it's not the obvious.
And maybe just for the clinicians, is it something that you're doing with kids with meningitis? You're actually doing some strengthening?
We're not doing the direct intervention, but provincially, there's much more focus on strengthening now than there was in the past. But what was highlighted in this presentation was doing it with the functional activities and looking for functional gains as an outcome.
There are several areas in pediatrics that are, well, most areas are under-researched except for cerebral palsy, which with regard to how common it is, you'll hear this from the Down syndrome people too. And there's just more need for more good research in with kids. So thank you. Unfortunately, we can't speed ahead because there may be other people coming, so you'll get a bit of a break and we'll start at 10, which is 5 to 10 on this clock, or 10 to 10 or something like that. Okay. Thank you very much.